Let's talk about separation anxiety. I think that we're going to follow the same kind of principles here. You can sneak out of the house when your child's not looking, okay? It works. And often it won't create a fuss. And maybe that works sometimes, and you want to do that sometimes just to avoid the problems that are associated with the fits of whatever. But there is another way, too, where you actually say to the child, I'm leaving now, get your coat on and say goodbye, and you have a little bit of the fuss. And then, you know, daddy's leaving, they cling to mom, or mommy's leaving, they cling to dad. And so there's the fussing that goes on, but they know that you're saying goodbye and that you're going to come back. So you're going to teach them. You may just leave for 10 minutes and come back. Mommy's back now. It may be that you're going out to the car, get your coat on, and they start fussing. You say, I'll be back in a minute. You need to just wait, and you separate instead of just trying to sneak out of the house. Again, what we're trying to teach them is this whole issue of separation. But sometimes children, it seems that children like me. And, you know, I love babies. Babies love me until they turn about 9 months. As soon as they turn about 9 months, they don't love me anymore because all of a sudden I'm different than, you know, they really can tell the difference between caregivers. Something happens in their brain about 9 months, and it sets them up for this separation anxiety. So I can't take, you know, they don't come to me. They're afraid of me at that point. But
they still come to me.
I know. That's so frustrating. I don't understand.
Sorry, I had to say that.
It is true, though. We're in counseling, you know, and it's a 9 month. How old is that baby that we're dealing with now? She's only about...
She'll be a year in July.
Oh, a year old, okay. Yeah. She comes into our office, and she cries just walking in the office. She sees me. She keeps her eye on me. They have to keep her head distracted so she can't see me because she cries whenever she looks at me. But she'll go and be with Joanne without any problem. But anyway... Separation anxiety is a problem, and when I was a director of a preschool, we dealt with this all the time. The parents who are most successful with this are ones who are willing to allow their children to cry for a little bit. This is so hard because if you hear your child screaming, you hate to leave. I mean, you leave them screaming in the nursery, and you go into the worship service, and you can't. How can you worship when you know your kid's screaming in another room, you know? Even though he may have stopped. And so you want to go check on him. You open the door, and he sees you and starts crying again. If we could just keep those parents away, the kids would do fine. Sometimes the separation anxiety isn't for the child, it's for the parent. And we have to work on that. But, you know, as children are struggling, let's take the nursery illustration. Let's say your children, or you drop them off at the nursery, they cry when you leave them, which is a normal, healthy response. You leave, you might hang around for a little bit or ask them to get you if he doesn't or she doesn't stop crying within about 15, 20 minutes. Then it's appropriate to come back in, love them, nurture them, like we said, because we don't want this to be a cold turkey kind of a get rid of this. We want to be nurturing at the same time. So you might come back in after 15, 20 minutes. Be with them, work in the nursery, help people out for a little bit. Next week, same thing. Leave them for 15 or 20 minutes. Come back. So that over the course of a week, you may do this several times where you're teaching the child that you're going to leave and come back and they can get distracted and play with something else. It's all part of the learning process. Some children have a much harder time with this than others. Some children could care less if you leave. I know that's disappointing to you. For some, but it's a process of growth. And some children have a harder time with that. They're more clingy, and we need to care for them and help them. Because anxiety and fear, the solution for anxiety and fear, I don't care what age you are, is positive experience over time. It's taking small risks over a period of time. The solution for fear and anxiety for us as believers is faith, to have faith. For an infant or a baby or a toddler, the idea here is that they're learning to trust the fact that mom will be back. They have to believe in something they can't see, that mom's coming back. Even before they're learning, we're going to talk about spiritual training in just a minute, but even before they're learning about God, they're learning how to trust mom and dad. And the fact that you say you're coming back and you come back is very important for a child, and they need to learn how to deal with that. But the process can be hard, and then we're trying to love them. At the same time, we're trying to teach them the independence that they need.
And I think at what stage you decide to push the issue is really an individual issue. Separation anxiety normally, naturally, most often starts between 9 and 12 months. That's kind of a typical time because the child is developing intellectually enough to realize that mom was here and mom's not here now. And they're distinguishing between different people and all that. And I know that some babies, you know, are always clingy with mom. And some of them, it doesn't start till 9 months, and sometimes it doesn't even start till later. But it's kind of a general window of when it starts, and how long it lasts, again, varies. And so when you're going to push the issue, you may not push the issue at 9 months. You might just want to stay there with them and say, okay, you want me, I'm here. But at some point, you're going to say, you know, they're developmentally a little bit more mature, and you start making that break for short periods of time, leaving them in a safe environment where maybe the environment is familiar, just you're taking mom out of the picture or dad out of the picture briefly and then coming back. So we want to work with them slowly, teaching them that it's an okay thing, rather than just trying to avoid the issue by sneaking out, because I'm not sure what that does for the trust thing, especially as they get older and they really realize that mom is gone now. You know, sometimes it's just the visually seeing the parent leave that's a problem, but sometimes it's really that I don't feel secure without mom. You know, I've been with her so much, and she does everything for me with dad. You know, I keep saying mom, but it can be true with dad, too. Dad goes off to work, and, you know, the baby's upset. And, you know, we want to give them those positive experiences and come back together and say, hey, it's okay.
Some parents ask us, is it okay to have our children sleep with us? And, again, we're going to approach this with the same kind of principles that we approach all the rest of the subjects. We don't think it's unhealthy necessarily that your children, if you have your children sleep with you, if it's so, if it fits into your family thing. I mean, there's a, you know, the whole family bed idea. We don't have a problem with that unless it becomes a problem for you. If it's causing a problem between you and your partner, then maybe it's time to create some independence. It can be a very effective form of birth control, but maybe that's not what you want at that point. And so there's a time when you may say, or single parents often will have their kids sleep in their bed with them when they're young, preschoolers. We don't believe that's necessarily wrong until it becomes a problem. When the children start developing some independence some dependence on parents in an unhealthy way, then we might start developing some independence at bedtime. So that's one of those things that we can negotiate, and we don't believe it's black and white. You'll find us say that most of the time in the way that we deal with parenting issues. All children are different, families are different, it depends on routines, and some family might have a 7 o'clock bedtime, another may not have a bedtime till 10 o'clock, but that may be because of dad's work schedule, and so all of those things need to be considered as we're developing some routines. We're more concerned about the character. We're more concerned about the routines that are being established and what's happening in the child rather than the little details about ages, when these things need to happen, or structures, little formulas. We don't think those are most beneficial for children as they're developing. Let's talk about toilet training just briefly. There are a lot of books written on toilet training. You can read all about them. We're, again, concerned at this point just to help parents get a sense of the major issues involved. I mean, one of the things to know is, how is your child ready? How do you know when your child's ready to start this toilet training? That's often a common question.
My sense is that many of you are kind of at that stage.
Sure.
Well, how do you know when to start potty training? So I would just go through a couple general principles about timing. Your child needs to be physically ready. They need to be able to hold their urine for a period of time, and that's often you can tell is if they wake up in the morning dry. If you catch them before they wet in the morning, you know, if they've held it, or you can tell during the day if they're dry for a longer period of time, that's a physical sign that they're ready. You also want them to be ready emotionally, though, and to be able to, just the whole thinking process. It's amazing when you stop and think about it. What a child has to do, if they've been wearing a diaper for how many months, all their life, and all of a sudden, they have to think about the fact, not only that they're going, but before they're going to go, and have to hold it, and have to be able to communicate to you that they have to go. That's a lot for this little person to have to deal with. Now, it's interesting to me that often they say that girls are easier to train than boys. Now, what I know about men is that they are still very focused on one thing. Whatever they're doing, they're focused on. And that's the way little boys play. And they're so focused on what they're doing, it's hard for them to think about whether they have to go to the bathroom or not. They may not even know after they've gone. So we want to take that kind of their emotional readiness. Are they able to think through the process and know what to do and be able to separate from the playing that they're doing to be able to communicate?
Are you saying that the reason that girls can get potty trained faster is because they're multitask?
You got it.
They can play and know that they got to go to the bathroom at the same time.
Isn't that amazing?
I see. What an interesting theory. That's amazing.
Anyway.
You know, I think also parents have to be ready.
Yeah, I just say one other thing. The child needs to be verbally ready. They need to somehow be able to communicate that they have to go to the bathroom and, you know, the whole think about what they're going to say before they say it and find mom and all that kind of stuff. So it's a verbal readiness. But you're right, the parent also has to be ready, because I think sometimes we think that once our child is out of diapers, life is going to be, we're going to have freedom. We don't have to take that diaper bag anymore. But once you get them into underwear, then you've got to be able to find a bathroom in 10 seconds or less every time. It's just, you know, wherever you go. The first thing you find out in the Acme is, where's the bathroom? You don't go to the park anymore, you know. Unless you're boys, I guess. We still went to the park.
Boys do have the girls. That's right.
Leave the girls home. I don't know. But it's hard. And I think sometimes as parents we say, you know, go to the bathroom now because we're going out. You know, the child's 2 years old. I'm not sure they're physically out because we're going out. So we need to be careful even of our own expectations. Some people say that potty training is easier in the winter because you're home all the time. Other people say it's easier in the summer because they don't wear many clothes. You know, whatever. You got to decide that you're ready. That you're ready to put aside several weeks or months to work on this so that you don't get frustrated. It's easy to get frustrated with kids because we think it's so easy. You know, if you have to go to the bathroom, you were just sitting there on the toilet. And now you're playing and you're wetting the floor. You know, why? And so it's easy to get frustrated with our kids. And, you know, I think as parents, we need to be emotionally ready for the accidents, for the stress, and not put that on our kids, because it's a whole new way of thinking for them.
Yeah, and you need to take it in stride. When they make mistakes, then you can't be disciplining them for that. It's all just in a positive way, trying to nurture them along as they're trying to develop some new self-discipline skills and communication skills and so on. Let's talk about spiritual training just briefly. Children at a young age, we're teaching them often some routines. We're teaching them how to pray. We're using spiritual terminology. We're singing songs to them. They're getting a positive feeling about being at church, hopefully. All of these things we're developing in the young child. Often with two-year-olds, we start by talking about Jesus because Jesus is something they can see or pictures they can visualize. Whereas we talk about God, but with young children, Jesus is something they can picture. He's concrete, and young children think very concretely. So we use those things. We pray with them, we sing with them, we talk about the Lord in fun ways. I think that's primarily the thing we want to associate, is just this positive sense of spirituality, that faith and fun go together. And it's a special thing that you're going to enjoy more and more as you grow. It's a positive thing.
Yeah, and just communicating the sense of love and that God loves you and He's created these things in the world for us to enjoy, and just kind of those positive, not, you know, if you do that, God's going to be sad, you know, or angry. You know, some parents will even say that. Don't make God angry, you know. And I'm not sure we want to go there with our young children, but keeping it positive, and so they develop this love and admiration for God and who He is.
Let's talk about anger and tears and tantrums that our children have. Two-year-olds become very emotional at times, and it's frustrating for us and for them to know how to deal with them. One-year-old can become very angry and throw tantrums. We believe that, we're setting patterns for them as they get older. What do you expect them to do when they're a teenager? You expect them to be able to take a break. They have to stop. They have to settle down. So you don't try to reason with an 18-year-old who's throwing a temper tantrum. It just doesn't work. Don't try to reason with them. Have them take a break. Or if we don't have them take a break, if we can ignore what's happening as they're on the floor in the house, that's different than if they're on the floor in the grocery store. But if we can ignore what's going on in that case, it often teaches the child that their anger doesn't really affect the world around them. It's their problem. But if you start engaging, you get angry, and you enter into this heavy, intense dialogue with them, then what are you doing? You're telling them, oh, this is a great way to get my mom involved here. And so now they've drawn you into something you don't want to be a part of. So if we can allow them to experience temper tantrum without any kind of response, they learn that my anger really doesn't change the world. I need to deal with this. And there are other ways to solve this problem. And so that's what we're trying to do. We have a whole tape on anger management for families and children. We're just trying to give you some precursors to prepare you for where you're going with this in order to have the threads that are going to carry you into some good routines and healthy routines as your children get older.
I'll say one other quick thing. It doesn't really relate to any of these categories, but I just feel like I need to say this. Sometimes parents feel like the way to motivate a child to do what you want them to do is by using what they call reverse psychology. You know, you put the food in front of them and say, don't eat that. And I would just want to warn against that kind of thing. And that is just an example of all the things that we're saying. Let's ask ourselves, what are we teaching our child by saying this? What are we doing here? Are we teaching them to disobey? You know, it may be cute when they're a year old, but it's not going to be cute if they're getting the message that, you know, I need to do the opposite of what mom and dad are telling me to do. It may work, but it's not the message we want to communicate. So we want to come back again and again and ask ourselves, what am I communicating by the things I'm doing with this baby, with this toddler, so that we're communicating the things we want to.
Let's give you a chance to ask some questions. So you can hone in on any of these issues we're talking about. Tell us your particular story. We'll try to troubleshoot it. Or we'll make some suggestions about what we would suggest in your particular situation. You can ask questions now. Yes, sir.
With regards to your separation anxiety,
yes.
Honestly, I was going to work out of the house, so I can get out of the house 20 times a day.
Yes.
Mom's at home, so there really isn't much of a separation anxiety with her. She's a little bit bigger. But I'm a little guy, 15 months old, waiting for my dad to leave. And generally, we do what you suggest. If I would do that consistently, I wouldn't generate any income. So I do sneak out occasionally, but other times it's just boring. Dad's got to go to work.
Yes.
But we just employ it and gotta go. Is there any way to, if you're doing it 20 times in a day as opposed to just once leaving work in the morning, is there any way to ease some of the frustration that
All right, so what you're saying is because you're a salesman working out of the house and you're in and out of his presence 20 times a day, he experiences this trauma 20 times a day. And so he's kind of, there's this growing anxiety, is dad going to be here, not going to be here, he's back in and out all the time. And so sometimes you're kind of sneaking out. And other time, and that kind of avoids a problem maybe because you're back in before he realizes it. And other times, you're confronting him and talking to him about it. And so we're just trying to see where do we go with this. It's a good question.
That is a good question.
And we are concerned at this point of how your little boy is processing this. And
well, actually, I'll call on the cell phone on the road. If I go back at 11 o'clock, I'm out back for a lunch call, and we sit down.
He rebounds
and he's having a great time.
The neat thing about separation anxiety is that children love us and they don't like to see us go. And that's actually a positive thing. They recognize us, they appreciate us, and I like that. That's a nice part of the picture. That's the good news, so to speak. The bad news is that it creates a problem. And I think what you're doing is great. And I would just suggest that positive time spent with dad over the course of, you know, a day or you know, in the evenings or whenever you're able will do a lot to just help him feel this comfort level with dad all the more, which I'm sure you're doing. But, you know, I like both of the things you're doing. See, I think it's good that if you're going to do it 20 times a day, maybe half the times you do need to sneak out of there. But I do think that sometimes we just need to say to him, look, I'm leaving, bud. I just want to say goodbye so that he can learn that he needs, that dad's going to be gone, but dad's coming back, and that's okay. Little babies, 15 months old, when something's not right in front of them, they think it's permanently gone. And so there's this object permanence that our babies experience, that when it's gone, it's not there anymore. And so what we're trying to do in the course of their development is help them see that dad's going to be back, mom's going to be back, and it's going to work. So I feel good about what you're doing. I think that it's the right thing, and over the course of time, your son's going to adjust to that, and he's going to feel okay and be doing well.
Yeah, and I think that if when you're home, if things are positive between you, and when you're gone, he settles down quickly, those are signs that he's doing fine with it. He's not angry with you for leaving. He's not taking it out on your wife. You know, so my sense is that he's dealing with it okay. He's sad, and I think we need to realize that our kids are going to be sad sometimes, and that's part of their life too. And continuing what you're doing, I think, is good.
Good.
This is the end of side three. Please turn the tape over and rewind to hear the conclusion of this session.
Somebody else. Yes.
It's in Romans 2, teaching responsibilities to authority. Regan is 13 months old and knows boundaries pretty well and knows that there are places that she's not allowed to go. But she's testing lately a lot. And for instance, there's two instances. One, when we open up the screen door, she pounds on the screen and it's starting to rip. And I'm afraid she's going to fall through it, so mm-hmm. I constantly tell her no. But it's such a draw to her, she's always yeah. going back. I try to hold her arms down and tell her no. She just looks at me honestly with defiance in her face and then goes right back. I slap her hand, it means nothing. I don't know what to do. The no means nothing to her. Disciplining her means absolutely nothing. And then the other instance that she has a problem is when she's eating, we have a dog, and she's constantly throwing one down to the dog. Yeah, she wants to share. So I removed the dog from the situation.
Good. Yes.
But she's still throwing food on the floor and watching me, keep making eye contact, and then dropping it off her tray. And I'm yeah. telling her no. And Reagan also doesn't eat a lot, so I'm afraid yeah. to just remove all the food.
Yes,
because
sir.
Then she's not going to eat. But I don't know how to deal with these.
Okay, so here we have a 13-month-old who appears to be deliberately defiant by pounding on the screen door continually, even after you spank her hand or put her hands down to her sides, both of things we would suggest, or pull her out of the situation, and throws food down on the floor, apparently in defiance, because of the dog that used to be there, and also because she's looking at you to see how you're going to respond. You know, first of all, I want to affirm the fact that you're unwilling to take the food away. That's a natural consequence. And we use natural consequences with children that are older. We say, okay, you're not going to take care of your bike? You can't play with it for a week. We have to be careful with 13 months old taking away food. I mean, it's just not an appropriate kind of discipline. So I just want to affirm that in you at this point, that we abandon natural consequences always when they can cause harm to people or to property. In this case, that kind of a natural consequence wouldn't be healthy for her. So I just want to affirm that, first of all. Now, you can... Defiance. Let's talk about the 13-month-old defiance.
Let me ask you another question about food. Okay, are you putting several pieces of food out on the high chair tray? Is that what we're doing? And she's eating some and throwing some down on the tray? What happens if you only give her one piece at a time? Does it go in her mouth or on the floor?
I've never done that.
Because I'm thinking that there's another natural consequence. That's a kind of a privilege and responsibility issue in a sense. The privilege of having this food is that you're responsible with it. But if you're going to throw it on the floor, you're not. Now, if we don't want to take it away from her because she still needs to eat, that I would give her less. I would maybe have to feed her or give her one piece at a time. It may take more of your time and attention. But it may teach her that what she's doing with it's not acceptable, so we're not going to allow her to do it. I would try.
That's a good suggestion, and you can try that also, because what you're trying to do with her is prevent her from having the opportunity to disobey. So with the screen door, I think I would try to draw a line somehow before the door so that there's some way that she can't get to the screen door, and if she passes that line, then we're not dealing with pounding, because maybe it's the touching of the screen door that is stimulating to her and she is having trouble resisting. So if we can pull her back to another line, that is, there happens to be a carpet in front of the screen door, and I don't want you going onto that carpet, and can try to draw a line there, we may be able to have some success. It's very possible that we may be asking of her something that she's unable to do at this point. I'm not certain that that's the case, but if you continually fail at discipline, in other words, there's no responsiveness, you're trying several different techniques to mold behavior, and you're not seeing a change in her, then we may need to do the distraction method, that she doesn't come into that room, or we put a barricade there so she can't get to it, so that it's really not an issue, we're going to come back to it later and allow her access to it at a later time. Yes.
Two questions. One problem is, at what age do they develop object codes? Children. You're saying 15-month-old doesn't have object codes. Is there an age at which they do develop?
I think sometimes they do it 15 months. I think it's between 12 and 15, generally speaking.
I don't know.
You don't think so?
Oh, you may be true. I can't answer that question. I don't know what the specific age is.
But you can test your child, though, to see if they have it. If they're playing with a ball and you take it away, if they go looking for it, then you know that they've developed object permanence. Now, that doesn't carry over into every situation, but that's kind of how we test for that. If they look for what's just disappeared, that makes distraction a little harder. That's why distraction is so much fun when they're little. You know, you take it away, you give them something else, and they're totally enthralled with what you're handing them. They get a little older, and they want to go look for the first thing. Not for very long, because their attention span is so short. You just shake this a little bit, and you've got them, but you can check
also,
it out.
One thing we've noticed just in the past month or so with Rachel is when we're just with Rachel, like I'm with her, or Adam's with her, she's fine with us, but when we're together, if we're like going for a walk or something, and Adam and I are holding hands, she stops what she's doing, and she comes over, hands, and or if we're hugging, she comes over, or if I go over to give him a kiss or something. The other night, he was sitting Indian style, and I had my head on his lap. She poked my head up and ran over, Daddy. And I don't want to make her feel insecure in her relationship with either one of us. But
how old is Rachel now?
22 months.
Okay, 22 months. And here, whenever you're walking along holding hands, she'll want to separate your hands. You put your head down on his shoulder or in his lap, then she wants to push you away. And okay, that's a good question. And it's common for children to feel uncomfortable when they see their parents cuddling or whatever. My teenagers don't like it when I hug my wife. I say, don't bother us, we're busy. Now they're teenagers, and so I say, we just need some time. We're going to smooch for a little while. But and they, you know, they get embarrassed about that. But that's a whole different problem than what you're experiencing. It may be that there's some...
She was so attached to Adam, like, because it seems like she definitely wants me away from him, so she...
Okay. It could be. And, you know, I have to say something about... children often have a preferred parent. It's not necessarily a mom. It's often the case that it's a mom, but sometimes it's a dad. And so, and it's different for each child. It doesn't make any statement about a mom or a dad. It's that children often have a preferred parent. They like to go to one as opposed to the other for various reasons. And so when they get hurt, they'll go to that one parent. Or when they get disciplined, they may respond to one parent differently than the other. So preferred parent is a common problem that parents, we just have to deal with. It's a fact of life. But let me tell you that sometimes it changes over time, that a child may prefer mom for a great bit of their young life and then move to dad as they get older. Or it may be reversed. So it can change. But don't be threatened by that. The same thing is true when a child is preferring it sounds like that Rachel has this thing for dad, okay? And that
it's more my concern that I want to explain to her this is okay for us to hold hands, but I don't want her to feel like she can't be near Adam when I'm there or something.
Yeah.
Like that. I don't want her to feel insecure.
Yeah, and so I would, if Adam then at this point would want to bring both of you into the picture. And so it'd be good for she's going to pull hands apart that you're both holding hands at that point, if that's what she's going to do. Or you may encourage Adam to be in the middle and mom on one side and Rachel on the other. Or it may be that you're laying in Adam's lap and he's holding Rachel or something. And it may be that you move at times. You may allow her to have a little bit of control here. I don't have a problem with that. But the goal here is that we're going to move her to a place where she can accept the fact that you and Adam are a team. And we're never going to allow her to triangle you. You know how some children go to one and that doesn't work, so I'm going to try the other and that works. And so we want to avoid that problem with the children. And we're starting to see triangling here in this illustration. This is a good illustration, you know, we can even see triangling down when they're almost 2 years old here. And so you're going to try to work with that. You're going to identify it as a problem, but it doesn't mean that every time you're going to say, no, I'm spending time with mommy now. We don't want to do that, but we're going to try to do both. We're going to set the limits, but we're also going to nurture at the same time. We're going to pull both of those things together and do what we can to embrace both at the same time or to show that it's okay for mom and dad to be together. We're going to hug. You know, you want to hug together? Okay. Now I'm going to hug Rachel. Now mommy's going to hug Rachel. Now I'm going to hug mommy. You know, just play the game. And so they learn in fun to see that it's okay. Somebody else. Yes.
I have two specific questions. The first one is about pacifiers.
Yes.
I personally have no problem with pacifiers. Yeah. I had a pacifier, actually several of them, until I was like 4 or 5. I mean, but with Devin, it's a oral motor issue. It's not really good for him to have a pacifier because of his tongue thrusting.
Okay.
And so we've been advised even like a year ago that we should take the pacifier away from him. And I haven't done it yet because he needs it. He needs it to sleep. That's the way he falls asleep. And I'm just wondering what would be a good way to wean him from pacifier.
Okay, here's a child who has an addiction to a pacifier so that he can sleep at night.
Good. Like, I mean, he used to need it all the time, and now it's only for sleeping. He doesn't have it to himself during the day.
Okay.
After his bottle.
All right, but it's been suggested that having a pacifier is not good for him because of his tongue thrust problem, and so it'd be best for him not to have a pacifier. How do we get him off the idea of a pacifier, or should we even have him stop with the pacifier? It sounds to me like you've already taken a major step, and so he only has it for the 10 or 12 hours that he's sleeping, not all during the day. So that's a major step, so he doesn't have access to it, I suppose, during the day, maybe just at naps and at bedtime. So that's a major step right there. Now, the question as to where you can drop it off at night is going to have more to do with when you sense that he has the ability to let it go and when he needs to let it go. But I see we're balancing here again the benefit of the sucking, the nurturing that he experiences with the desire for him to be independent so that he can deal with the tongue thrusting problem. And neither of them are good, and so we've got to somehow choose a plan in the middle that's going to allow for that. It may be that, is it okay for him to have a pacifier as he goes to sleep for an hour, and then you take it away from him for the rest of the night? So now, out of 24 hours, he has a pacifier for 1 hour out of the whole time. Is that a problem? Maybe he needs it for that 1 hour in order to feel the nurturing component of being able to go to sleep. So the goal is here, we're trying to push both sides, and it's like some children or parents will breastfeed for extended periods of time. We have, and I'm not suggesting, I'm going to another subject, not particularly yours, but we had two families in our office in the last few weeks, both of them breastfeeding after age 4. Now, most families would reject that for a variety of different reasons. We don't reject it outright. Okay, we suggest that it's another one of these things where you need to balance the nurture and the independence. And sometimes the benefits that come from long-term breastfeeding are a real good benefit for a child. I'm not just talking about the benefits in the immune system and all that kind of stuff that we can debate. I'm talking about the nurturing benefits, the emotional benefits that a child gets from that action. So we're not opposed to it outright, but when a parent believes that this is not something that needs to happen anymore, or when the parent realizes that really maybe this is a parent thing and not a child thing anymore, and maybe the parent wants the breastfeeding, the mom wants the breastfeeding more than the baby does, maybe then it's time to make a change. Again, we're trying to balance these two concepts, and having children breastfeed for long periods of time isn't necessarily a bad thing. Maybe one more question. Yes.
My daughter's just picked up a bad word.
Yes.
And she's getting a reaction everywhere she goes. And I try to say, like, what's going on, what's wrong, or going to your room, time out. But she says it properly, and she's always just going to giggle. Or a neighbor will giggle after she says it. And the first time she said it, you chuckle a little. But it's not fine.
Yeah. Okay, so here we have a child who's picked up a bad word, and it's because she's so young, when she says it, it's remarkable to people, and so they think it's funny, right? Yeah, so how many months is she?
So she's 3 in October.
Okay, so she's about 27 months. Okay.
Young, you know, some people wish their kids were talking at that age.
Yeah, okay, so it's a little older than that. But regardless, here she's picked up a word that's not good. Again, it's very important that, first of all, you got to find out where she got this, because if there's a source somewhere, like watching TV or...
She keeps saying, first she says her teacher, which I know.
Yeah.
Then she said her sister, which I maybe believe. She's 12.
Okay.
So, I don't know if it comes
all right.
Appropriate time to buy all time music up, it's the D word, blanket.
Okay.
Turn it up, and I'll say, okay, I'm going to talk like that.
Yeah.
Like, okay,
okay, we need to talk about why we don't say that. I don't say, does mommy say that? No, that's a bad word. She knows it's a bad word.
All right, so then, okay, every time that she does it, we're going to take some action. Okay, every time she says this word, you can do a number of things. Here she is almost 30 months old. She's ready for some kind of discipline. So you can, it depends on your relationship.
Start within 1 week, yeah.
All right, so right away now, we want to squelch this. So here's what you could do is every time she says it, you can say, oh, no, you said that word again. Come on over here. I'm going to have to give you a swat on your bottom. And she's probably wearing diapers.
No, but she's fine, but unfortunately, she's like, all right, I want to
come
in.
Okay. So you can use that. You know, if the pain that is applied at that situation is helpful, then it may work. Another one is that we're going to take her and we're going to say, oh, no, I'm sorry, we don't talk that way, and be firm with her and set her down somewhere and say, okay, I want you to come back now, and I want you to say sorry and give me a hug.
I put her in a room, and that seems, and she doesn't like that. But how do you deal with the other people that are laughing at her that think it's funny?
Okay, first of all, I don't think I'd put her in a room because it's too long, too far away. I would rather deal with her on the spur of the moment, just right here for a few seconds. We can't put her away for too long. I would discipline severely anybody who laughs. In other words...
Certainly a sibling.
Yes, because...
Because they need to partner with you now to help.
That's right. This is wrong. Okay, I would make an issue out of it. And I would discipline the neighbor's kids,
sure.
Discipline the neighbor's parents, discipline whoever is laughing. I'm going to say, look, I'm having a problem with Michaela right now, and you're laughing at her, and so she thinks it's funny. I need your help, so that whenever she says that word, I don't want you smiling at all. You need to help me discipline her. So you elicit the help of everyone that you can to take some firm action. And then if anybody responds in an inappropriate way by laughing, you want to say, I am so disappointed. And discipline whoever it is. I need your help. This isn't funny. I'm having a problem here. And then just take Michaela out of there. Let me just pray for us all before we go, okay? And Heavenly Father, I pray for the families that are represented here that you would bless them. That you would give parents wisdom that only you can provide. We thank you that you love us and that you care about us as your children. And Lord, give us the ability to respond to you in the way that we want our children to respond to us. Teach us what it means to be your children, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
This concludes this tape series. We trust that you have benefited from the Ministry of Effective Parenting. Together, Scott Taransky and Joanne Miller have written books and several other tape series. Effective Parenting is a nonprofit ministry committed to strengthening the family through teaching, counseling, and producing materials for parents and children. Our goal is to build families where God is honored and where parents are finding fulfillment in their roles as mom and dad. To learn more about the Ministry of Effective Parenting, call 609-771-8002 or 1-800-771-8334. Books and tapes are available, as well as information about upcoming conferences. Thank you for participating with us in this series. We pray that God will bless your family as you apply the things taught in these sessions.